Prime ministers
and presidents
may come and go, but the certainty of exemplary entertainment on the Midweek Drive
and the Midweek Drive Morning Edition
remains.
That's Lily Holloman, affecting an accent.
I look back to see those blue skies. Were there better days between the hellos and the goodbyes, the promises we made? And looking back, we had the chances. How many did we throw away? But you can't go back just to start it all over. No second chance is time, and all I have looking over my shoulder is just a memory of you, of a world we left behind. And all I have looking over my shoulder is just a memory of you. We can recall our favorite places like it was yesterday. I put a name to all those faces that slowly drift away. No matter how you fight the changes, we'll never be the same again. But you can't go back just to start it all over. No second chance.
In 1931, Great Britain was still suffering the impact of the Great Depression, and it was a difficult time for a 15-year-old girl and her three younger siblings to be bereft and alone. Bettina finds help from her aunt and uncle, who are a kind, wealthy, well-respected couple with no children of their own. So begins a narrative which is rich in detail, reflecting the changes in society over the decades with the tremendous growth of technology and healthcare, written by Hetty Aston. And we're delighted to actually say Hetty is with us today. How are you, Hetty Aston?
Good morning. I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. So I trust you recognise those words that were taken from Threads of Steel, the opening in the trilogy of three texts that you've actually been putting together, because, of course, Little Bronze Girl is out and about as well in terms of downloadable and purchasing matters.
It is.
Okay, now there are folk who'll be listening to this, Hattie, who'll be saying, yeah, that's fine, another author, Southside Broadcasting and Midweek Drive, of course, on Siren Radio, renowned for regularly giving authors, both well-respected ones, award-winning, new authors, new writers, etc., the chance. But every writer has their own particular story and approach to the whole essence. And one of the things about being in these socially distanced times, using the studios at the James Cook University Hospital, is that there's a connection with that, of course, and the connection is, before you even turned to professional writing, Hetty, you were an official SRN, State Registered Nurse, for over 40 years.
I was, yes, and I started my nurse experience, or not my training, it was pre-training, at Carter Bequest Hospital in Middlesbrough.
Yeah,
and in 1959,
and of course we can still actually see the pillars that were actually there. Oh no, I'm thinking of a completely different place. Actually, that's actually. I mean, I know the hospital is no more because everything relocated and repackaged together onto the mega site that used to be South Cleveland Hospital and is now, of course, the James Cook University Hospital.
Yeah.
So again. It goes without saying, stacks of changes in that particular almost half century period. Was writing something that actually, in betwixt dealing with saving lives and generally being an all round wonderful soul within the nursing profession, did you always sort of think, yeah, actually, I'd quite like to write about this now?
Well, you know how it is, Alex. People say everyone's got a book in them. Hmm. And I often wondered, did I have a book in me? And, you know, life took over and you do your nursing and you look after your family and somehow the book gets put on the back burner. But since retirement, I've taken up the hobby of quilting. And I became the chairperson of a quilting group. And I wrote a newsletter 4 times a year for the quilting group. And people were saying to me how much they enjoyed the newsletter. And then that made me think, well, perhaps I could do a bit of proper writing and write, you know, a book, a novel, which I've done. And I've actually done the third one in the trilogy, which is at the publishers now. So that's how it started.
Yeah, I'm working my way through Threads of Steel, of course, and a lovely little line here taken from Catastrophe, Chapter 4. Life at Iona House felt good, and we were all looking forward to Christmas. Olive was thriving, and Vera was a natural mother in every way. She seemed to be content and enjoying motherhood. I loved my bedroom and considered it to be my special place. I could not help wondering what Mam would have thought if she could see me living in such luxury. Talk us through, actually, the plot line, as much as we can, of course, because no spoilers in terms of
no
this,
but talk
us through this northeastern setting, because again, I was fascinated in terms of how you obviously related this period, which, I mean, clearly, Hetty, yes, I know you started off in 1959, but that's still a long time, still 30-odd years after your time period for this particular novel.
Well, this time period in the 30s fascinated me always, because as a child, we didn't have TV, you know, in our house. We didn't have a TV till, I think, the coronation. Most people got a TV. And so most of our time was spent visiting aunties and things like that. And I was a great one for listening into conversations. And they talked about the 30s and the pre-war period. They did talk about the war as well. But the 30s was a time when a lot of them were young and they were going to the pictures, going dancing, having fun. You know, there were young people then, these older people in my family. And so it did fascinate me this time. And there was a lot going on in the pre-war time. Nobody ever dreamt there'd be another war because the Great War had just been too awful. And so they were all starting to think they were coming out of the Depression, rebuilding their lives, you know, having a future. And it was a good time. It was a time when people had hope, you know, for the future. And I looked at a lot of photograph albums. People had massive photograph albums with their weddings and special occasions. And I just had been fascinated, I don't know why, with this time that people talked about when I was a child. Yeah.
It's often been said that as a nation, British folk tend to be one that stagger backwards into the future, looking longingly at the past. And of course, there's the old classic quote, the past is a different country. They do things differently there. There are similarities. There are connections together. I mean, I think it's ludicrous, the parallels that have been made between the Second World War and where we are now with respect to the pandemic, because we don't have the threat of bombs, thank the Lord. And in terms of issues relating to that, we're having to get on with it just as people have always got on with it. But there is this sense, as you said, that you've got lots of global events taking place, like the Wall Street crash, the Depression, the Jarrow March, presumably, again, would sort of work within that whole field. At the same time, the movies are there. Clearly,
big
difference from that point of view, that actually people could actually go to the cinema quite safely in those days, or at least as safe as it's there.
And this is where they got their information. This is where, apart from newspapers, of course, the Pathé News was a big thing. They used to like to see the news. And, of course, when we come on to Little Bronze Girl, that is the time that we move a few years, and it's the time of the abdication.
Yeah,
so there was a lot going on, you know, with the royal family as well.
Certainly. I mean, again, the whole line of newsreels, which were extraordinarily popular, probably the best equivalent in terms of contemporary times to the newsreel would be the regional news shows like Look North and so on, because they would sort of compile things together. Obviously, they tried to make sure that they weren't dated, so they could actually have several screenings, and they didn't actually lose things entirely. And again, there was an issue that a lot of the newsreel editors were self-censoring in terms of what they wanted to put together, because obviously nobody, if you're a cinema owner, wants to offend their audiences. So they wanted to kind of keep things fairly neutral. In fact, I think there was a lot of debate at the time in terms of whether the abdication should be covered, the issues relating to that. I know that we were at the hind end as far as radio was concerned of Reith's tenure at the BBC. Mm-hmm. And there was a sense that, well, why do you cover this? Where should you cover this, etc.? And I mean, the other issue, of course, from a Northern point of view, is Ellen Wilkinson, Middlesbrough MP at the time, was one of the people who actually threatened to stop paying her licence fee because the BBC refused to report on the general strike because it took the government line.
Well, exactly. Yes. Very strange times. There were a lot of censorship, as you say. Yes.
And in particular, I mean, again, that novel that was clearly working through that. Did you actually decide, yeah, well, I need to hone this skill? Did you kind of, once you left the nursing profession, say, I'm going to do a creative writing course? Or was it just a case of, it's in me, I'm going to actually type it out?
No, I haven't done a creative writing course. I just sort of sat on the bed with my cat, and I wrote it all in longhand. All three books I've written in longhand, and then I've got an old laptop, which I'm learning as I'm on a steep learning curve with technology, shall we say, and just sort of tapped it out.
Yeah, I mean, interesting. We were speaking to an author in Calgary, Canada, yesterday, who also actually writes using a pen. I was staggered.
Yeah.
I mean, I was just amazed that you know, a pen, a biro, yeah. an ink pen, yeah, to actually write things through. Honestly, yeah, you were saying it'll be quill next. there is that sense, of course, and we've spoken to writers who sometimes feel that using a keyboard can be a bit impersonal, that somehow when you're actually writing things out in longhand, it almost connects you on an emotional being to the characters that you're working with. Did you find that?
Yes, I think you're right there. It's a slower process, and there's lots of crossings out and arrows and asterisks and, you know.
It's like a proper writer in the 20th century, isn't it? Or at least the early 20th century, the 19th century almost, really.
Yeah, I mean, the originals are not a pretty sight because there are lots of changes, and I'll be ironing or doing something, cooking, and I'll think, oh, that character would have said that or done that. And the characters are with you all the time, I find, anyway.
Sure. Well, again, it's a cliche, we've said it so many times, but there is that philosophical line that there's no such thing as fiction in the cosmos, that our fiction is somebody else's reality, and vice versa, somebody who's actually just writing these words that we're saying at this moment in time. Strange, but true.
I hope my books touch the emotions. I think that's what I'm trying to get, is, you know, there are sad things that are happening, and there are happy times, And people in those days, anyway, and now as well, make the most of the good times.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in Little Bronze Girl, it starts off with whooping cough, which is very relevant to today because the children had to go into isolation.
Yeah, exactly.
And you think, well, there's nothing new under the sun. We're having a pandemic, but infectious diseases have always been around.
In the 1950s, we had polio. In the 90s, obviously, in certain parts of the world, you were suffering from Ebola. There are all sorts of things there. Again, the maxim that we had in World War II, coughs and sneezes spread diseases, hasn't changed, really. Washing your hands is very important, but there we are. So that's a different line. Ever tempted, Hetty, to actually write about your nursing experiences, or is it a case of, well, I could, but I'd have to change the names to protect the innocent?
Oh, well, I would have to, obviously. But nursing does come in, not so much in Threads of Steel, but into Little Bronze Girl and into the third book, there is more about nursing. But all in a fictitious way, you know. And it's all fictitious.
In terms of, obviously, what became the norm for authors who would actually be attending book festivals and signing books and meeting their readers and actually reading excerpts, etc., and doing interviews like this, of course, and sometimes face-to-face and so on, and sometimes telephonically and so on, that's actually changed. So getting the word out there, and clearly you can obviously access both Threads of Steel and Little Bronze Girl through most online websites and go to download them for that. If you like the electronic system, if you sort of think, what's a Kindle, is it available as a traditional text that you can go into a bookstore and actually say, I'd like to have a copy of Hetty Aston's Threads of Steel and Little Bronze Girl, please?
You can. I mean, it's obviously available on Amazon in Kindle format and paperback. But as far as the bookshops are concerned, I haven't been able to sort of go into any bookshops and discuss this with the manager. But I understand that you can order it through a bookshop,
and presumably this is all being done as a self-published author, presumably, so you've got all of that to work through as well.
Yes, and so I have to I have written a lot of emails, as you might imagine, just approaching people like yourself who kindly will do an interview and talk about Threads of Steel and Little Bronze Girl.
Oh, we're always happy to promote local talent and work through that process. Intriguingly, we often, as you might imagine, we get lots of requests. In fact, we're just about to cover the annual book awards in terms of authors of the year and so on. So we've got a whole bank of interviews. But most of again, that comes through agencies and so on. But it's always quite nice to actually have a new author who's just actually written a few bits and pieces. And I have to say, you know, having looked through, as you might have gathered, certainly Threads of Steel, I haven't really got on to Little Bronze Girls yet. Very impressive, good characterisation. It's well worth getting hold of. I think it's a marvellous text. I mean, even just looking at the chapter titles, you've got chapter 16, Huddersfield. I mean, who would have thought, you know, a whole chapter on Huddersfield? I'm just astounded, you know?
I know. Have you read that Huddersfield one yet? Or?
It's intriguing, yeah.
But no spoilers.
No, exactly. Well, that's precisely it, you know. So I just want to leave that whole thing through.
Yeah.
Hetty Aston is the name. That's Hetie Aston, as in Aston.
As in the car.
Or indeed the football club, Villa.
Oh, yes.
Just thought, exactly. It's just true. Yeah. Aston Martin, Aston Villa. Oh, very easy. So you can access both Threads of Steel, Book One, and indeed Little Bronze Girl, and the third one in the trilogy will be entitled.
It's going to be called Circlet of Gold.
And in a temporal sense, when is it actually set? When's it?
They all follow on. The 31 was the start of the first book, and we finish New Year's Day 1937.
So we're approaching those periods of times where basically a certain gentleman called Chamberlain will be coming back saying, I have a piece of paper in my hand from Herr Hitler, etc., who's peace in our time.
The storm clouds of war were definitely on the horizon.
Yeah.
By the end of the third book, anyway. Yeah.
And in the year 2021, we're supposedly leaving Europe again. Never mind. That's another issue, which I'm not even going to start on that one, Hetty, because we'd be here for all sorts of times. We've got two final questions for you. First of all, Hetty Aston, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
It's been lovely, Alex. Yes, I have. It's been very interesting and lovely talking to you.
Well, the next critical question is, will you be kind enough to return? Will you come back and, who knows, maybe actually do a short reading and a couple of excerpts from the text as well? Will you return?
I certainly would, yes. Would you like me to do that?
That would be splendid.
Yes. Oh, that is lovely. Now, which bits would I choose? I certainly would like to do that. Yes. Thank you. Yes.
In the window in the night, caught for a second by the light, ashes of memory still aglow, only for you, portraits and pictures you once saw. Visions in blue, read while the letters still remain. Sip from the wine of youth again. Oaths made in silence still return. Cast like a shroud, you're clutching on visions in blue. Catch aimless smiles from passers-by. Blistered and broken in reply. Second by the light, ashes of memory still aglow. Portraits and pictures you once saw.
Yes, well, the kind of somber tones that you would probably actually get in a few weeks' time in London if it goes into lockdown two, which of course is probably where many folk would actually say that's where you should be. You crazy, crazy folk, Richard Fitzwilliams, partying down like no. And so, it's all very well the Ritz opening, but that's not going to help. It should be shut down completely.
I do not agree that it should be shut down completely. I think, obviously, I mean, we know there have been excesses. But we're also, one of the problems with all this is that we're dealing with something that's completely unprecedented. How will the second wave affect people? It does seem to be somewhat different from the first. So I am no expert on the subject. And those who are, very often disagree.
Well, I mean, if it helps, I believe that David Icke is speaking on the topic today, so he'll have a lot of sensible things to say.
Yes, no, that really would be something that I'd like to be
involved in. Or else we could all move to Sweden, who haven't had a single lockdown, and they're still seem to be okay. But what the hey, let's just carry on regardless. Richard, it's good to connect with your good self as ever. And it's time for you. Unless you want to speak briefly about the lovely piece you said about VFM and the Royal Family household. Noticed, again, you'd admitted really any mention of the real moneymakers in terms of the firm, of course, Meghan and Harry, who are obviously doing their own stuff with Netflix these days.
No, I didn't. In fact, there is a Mail Online piece and an Express piece, not to mention my pieces on BBC Kent and LBC, which you presumably didn't hear.
Are there other radio stations other than Siren Radio? I'm astounded.
That is a matter that we could dispute and debate. But of course, regarding the royal finances, the amount spent for 2019-20, some 82 plus million pounds, excluding security, made up of 49 million, which is from the sovereign grant that succeeded the civil list in 1760. George III swapped the income from the crown lands for a civil list, and the civil list was abolished in 2012. The sovereign grant has subsequently taken its place. It's mainly for the upkeep of royal palaces and also for staff costs and for travel, and that some 49 million. And then we've got the Queen gets under the sovereign grant 15% of the revenue, part of the profit from the Crown lands, which is over £300 million. It was no bargain for the Crown, what happened in the 18th century. But the facts also are that for 10 years, so that Buckingham Palace should be refurbished for the first time, for, well, much of it dates back to the 1950s when it was last done, £369 million over 10 years, another 10% of the sovereign grant. That basically explains the 82 million, 49 million from the sovereign grant, 33 million from the refurbishment of Buckingham Palace.
Richard, it's far too early in the morning to do mathematics. I mean, we need to actually just save our arithmetical calculations for another period of time.
We could also mention, I was just coming to the travel, and that was £250,000 for the 245 to be precise, for Harry and Meghan's trip to South Africa or Southern Africa. Initially, it had gone absolutely brilliant.
And some people would actually say she at least found freedom, the road to freedom on that particular
Without mentioning that book, which is the subject now of a fierce legal dispute, the facts of the matter are that they ruined what had been an enormously successful trip at the end, because
People might say ruin, some people might say liberation.
I'm talking about the specific trip in which you asked. It's simply that they were representing the Queen in a Commonwealth country, and she launched her privacy lawsuit against the Mail on Sunday for reproducing extracts of a letter she wrote to her father whilst in South Africa. That was what I thought was disastrous. And, of course, it did set in motion what my husband probably coming anyway, and that was eventually their stepping down as senior working royals, which is very sad. That was the headline. The other thing regarding the royal accounts that I must mention is that obviously this particular year back doesn't include the effects of the pandemic, and that is estimated to be some 20 million from the refurbishment of Buckingham Palace and 5 million for 3 years.
As I say, you can churn out the figures, Richard, but if somebody is anti-monarchy, they're not going to be impressed at all by
that.
Well,
of course, if they're anti-monarchy, they don't look at the figures. They don't realise how much the royals bring in. Just to give you one other figure, and that is, which you should praise, incidentally, we all should, the Prince's Trust will soon, according to a royal source, welcome its 1 millionth young person that it's helped. Now, that is amazing. You must admit that.
Well, so amazing. The Duke of Edinburgh Award was also equally fantastic.
That's extraordinary. 1956. Yes, nearly 70 years.
So, Let's talk movies. What wonderful silver screen or indeed home video entertainments are you going to be providing for us this week?
Well, firstly, I'd like to talk about La Haine. That means hate. It's a French film, and just like Memories of Murder, which we recently talked about from South Korea, it's a reissue. It was made in 1995 and was written, directed, and co-edited by Matthew Kassovitz. It's set in Parisian Banlieues, and it depicts 20 hours in the lives of three friends of Abdel, who is on death's door after a riot, having been beaten up by police. They're all from immigrant communities, and in the aftermath of the riot, someone has a revolver, one was lost. It turns out to be Vince. He's Jewish, he's aggressive, he wants to revenge Abdel, he hates the police. There's a sense in which he's modeling himself on Travis Bickle of Taxi Driver, and he intends, if Abdel dies, to shoot a policeman. Then there's Hubert, an Afro-French boxer. He's a small-time drug dealer. He's thinking of leaving the city for a better life. His boxing gym was destroyed in the riot. And he is someone who basically, to the beginning, he wants out. Then there's Saïd, played by Saïd Tamoui. Hubert Combes, Hubert, and Vincent Cassel is Vins. Saïd is the moderator, so to speak, a bit. He isn't like, his temperament is very different to Vins. On the other hand, it's a tricky business when you're caught in a situation like this, because you can see the aimlessness, the poverty, there's the crime. They represent discontented youth in a situation that's spiraling out of control. And the strength of this movie, and everyone remarked on it at the time, was it has a feeling of a docudrama. So whereas the actors are all superb, you don't really feel that these are performers. You feel that this might well be a documentary camera recording what is really going on. Some fascinating parts of this movie, including the time when they visit a rather flamboyant taker of cocaine and also someone who likes Russian roulette. François Levental plays Asterix, an extraordinary role there. And some surreal bits, for example, when they're in a guest room and suddenly a gulag survivor comes out of one of the latrines and tells a terrifying story of a friend who froze to death whilst refusing to relieve himself in public, which is a surreal moment in a movie that it has a tension, it has an impetus. You believe something's going to, you know something must be dramatic happening climactically. By goodness me, you'll never forget what does. No spoilers obviously here, but the facts are that this is an audaciously cinematic climax to a very powerful movie, and if you haven't seen it, and I hadn't, do take the opportunity. First-class performances, superb direction, and very pertinent today.
Produced a quarter of a century ago, as you rightly said, La Haine. Okay, Richard, we're going to take a short musical break, and then we'll be back with another movie suggestion from your good self. But speaking about the monarchy, here's a classic monarchist moment.
Trailer for sale or rent, rooms to let 50 cents. No phone, no pool, no pets, ain't got no cigarettes. Oh, but 2 hours of pushing broom buys a 8x12 4-bit room. I'm a man of means by no means, king of the road. Third boxcar, midnight train, destination Bangor, Maine. Wool worn out suit and shoes, I don't pay no union dues. I smoke old stogies I have found, short but not too big around. I'm a man of means by no means, king of the road. I know every engineer on every train, all of the children and all of their names, and every handout in every town, and every lock that ain't locked when no one's around. I sing trailers for sale or rent, rooms to let 50 cents, no phone, no pool, no pets. Ain't got no cigarettes, but 2 hours of pushing broom buys a 8x12 4-bit room. I'm a man of means by no means, king of the road. Trailers for sale, rent, rooms to let 50 cents, no phone, no pool, no pets. Got no cigarettes, but...
could almost be the theme for King Boris of England. I'm sure it'll happen in the next few years. Because, let's face it, after Europe, where else can we go? Obviously, heavy political point there, Richard. Subtly done, perhaps. Subtly done.
Well, I'm taking you now to... this will be, I feel sure, the place you won't want to go. The People's Republic of China.
Yeah, you see, they're kings of the road once again. Pushing broom? I don't know.
Well, I thought it was important to deal with a massive Chinese film because, firstly, as you know, there was the controversy, a tremendous amount of controversy about Disney's handling of Mulan. There's no doubt at all that the fact that its chief actress, Yifei Liu, supported the actions of the Hong Kong police, and that the film apparently... gather credits the Communist Party Publicity Department in Qingyang, which is where the persecution and alleged genocide of the Uyghur people is taking place. I mean, that was an absolute catastrophe. The film, however, praised by most critics, but you will recall that I thought it wouldn't.
Yes, Richard, but you see, that's because you were just not seeing it on a big screen, which is where it's meant to be seen, on a huge IMAX-based screen, but that's not going to happen.
Well, firstly, it isn't, because had it been, I remind you of Sam Goldwyn's quip, a widescreen just makes a bad film twice as bad.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid...
That's what I say about Master and Commander on a weekly basis, as you're
well
aware.
Well, you gave it 7 out of 10, come on. No, I have to say, when it comes to Mulan, no, it was colourful, harmless enough, but it was a missed opportunity. It wasn't exciting, and the battles were not well done. Action scenes that I thought were a bit of a dud. So I didn't think much of it. No, but what here we're dealing with... the world's second largest film industry, and also the fact that Chinese cinema going over the last decade, it's gone up 5 times. It's 21% of the world's cinema goers in China, or the box office was in China, which is huge. And we're dealing with a film called The 800. This was about the early days of the Second Sino-Japanese War. The Imperial Japanese Army invaded Shanghai. They held the Chinese Army under Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek, holds the Japanese for 3 months, but it's in full retreat. Lieutenant Colonel Ji Jinyang, played by Du Chun, of the 88th Division, leads 452 soldiers. This is known as the 800 because it was said that there were 800 that weren't, to defend the Sihang warehouse against the 3rd Imperial Japanese Division. It's considered a suicidal last stand. What is interesting is that across the Suzhou Creek, you have the international settlements. And they are the French, the British and others. The Japanese can't use heavy artillery because what if a shell landed there? And that also plays a very considerable part in the diplomatic pressure that they are trying to exert to stop the invasion. The West watch it. Thousands, in fact, watch it from the international settlements across the creek, and also an airship flits above. It's quite surreal above the warehouse whilst the Japanese are attacking to give Westerners a view of what's going on. I mean, this is the propaganda aspect of it that the Chinese want. There is no question that this is an epic film. It was meant for IMAX. I have to say, pity is it's 2.5 hours. Too long. I mean, the Chinese can do a terrific battle film as in Red Cliff, which was one period film. This is set in 1937, and yes, it's an epic scale. The Japanese side is fleetingly, you'll get an idea of what their plan is, but nothing like what it could have been. The tension here, this is where I felt its length so much. It's well enough done in parts, and I was fascinated. Across the other side of the creek, you have the theatres, you have the hotels open, you have the nightlife. It's normality, except when mustard gas is used against the warehouse. There's the raising the flag aspect of it, the propaganda aspect of it. There's no doubt that is maximized. Painfully, I felt, by director Guan Hu. Eventually, I felt that the length of the film and its repetitive nature rather told against it, but it certainly is a legendary episode in the history of China, and one that they remain extremely proud of. There is no doubt whatsoever that it's a spectacle, and if you are interested in this sort of thing, and there are limited numbers who are, there was only one other person in the cinema with me, this is a movie that you will find intriguing, because, as I say, they could have cut an hour out of it from my point of view, and that's a lot. But there are interesting aspects to it, and it's certainly unusual.
The 800 is the name of the suggestion there. I think I'll wait until it actually comes onto a portable device or a streaming service. Don't go to the cinema. It's not worth the risk. Sorry, Richard, I'm just sort of raising that issue.
Well, that is not a very helpful or cheerful note, I have to say. I mean, a lot of people have this view, but I do have to say...
No time to die, no time to go to the cinema. That's the line.
I would say to you that Rocks, which I will be discussing next week, there were 20 people in the cinema. So that's got a little better.
Dear Lord, that's just getting worse and worse. There we are then. Okay, La Haine, of course, the other recommendation. We've moved on quite a little bit from our earlier correspondent, Hetty Aston, and her Threads of Steel and Little Bronze Girl. But life continues. The two questions are really the same, however. Richard Fitzwilliams, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
I have.
Are you able to join us again in about 7 days' time?
I am.
Fantastic. 1937 was the year of the 800. At the same time in 1937, Frank Capra was producing the awesomely wonderful mega movie and feel-good epic Lost Horizon. In 1973, Peter Finch was part of the musical version, which was also an epic, even though it was much underrated by critics at the time. I have to say, it is a classic well worth seeing. Burt Bacharach here with The World is a Circle from the musical version of Lost Horizon.
You surprise me.
I surprise you.
Yes. That you, who have written so much of better worlds, should think it a dream when you find one? Or is it that you fail to recognize one of your own dreams when you see it? And this is our school. This is where we start to prepare our young for the future.
Small, that doesn't mean that you're small at all. And just the like a tree to a twig. To someone else you are big. The world is a circle without a beginning, and nobody knows where it really ends.
Whoa.
Everything depends on where you are in the circle that's spinning around. Half of the time we are upside down. La 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 la. And just because they say you're weak, that doesn't mean you are weak, the Zeke. And even if they're partly right,
at least they're partially wrong. To someone else you are strong.